Okay, welcome everybody. It's a great crowd today. We're just bringing in a few more chairs because we expect some more stragglers. And I'm Karen Von Hippel, the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project here at CSIS, along with Rick Barton, who many of you know. And it's my great pleasure to welcome Jim Drummond from DFID and Mark Ward from UNAMA here today to talk to us about development challenges in Afghanistan. I think we all realize that this is one of the most extraordinary challenges that we're facing right now in Afghanistan. And we're very fortunate to have two members of the A-team here with us here today to talk about how they plan on ramping up their own work, really how do we get aid more directly to the people, dealing with some of the extraordinary challenges that we face in a place with low literacy rates, with enormous security problems, other issues. I think most of you know Mark. He is the special advisor on development to the special representative of the Secretary General in Afghanistan for UNAMA. UNAMA, as we all know, has been tasked to be lead coordinator in Afghanistan, but it has had trouble assuming this role. And so Mark is going to help us understand how UNAMA will really increase its capacity. I think we should all look at UNAMA in many senses as our exit strategy. So a strengthened UN is good for everybody in Afghanistan. And then Jim Drummond, who is the South Asia Division Director at DFID, the Department for International Development in the United Kingdom, will talk about their recently released strategy. I think most of you are familiar with DFID's work. DFID is one of the more innovative development agencies out there. And so we're all looking forward to hearing his comments. Both speakers will speak only for about 5 to 10 minutes, so we have time for discussion. This is being podcast, so if any of your friends want to listen or you want to listen later and really think about what people are saying, it should be online tomorrow. So let's start out with Mark first. Is that all right?
Sure.
And then we'll move over to Jim. So thank you.
Apparently it's a boring Thursday afternoon in Washington. Glad we could give you something to do. Thanks very much, Karen. Nice to see you. Always a pleasure to see Jim at Palace Street or Washington or Kabul, wherever it happens to be. What I wanted to talk about today is a fairly topical topic. And that is the, I don't know what we're calling it now, but we're always behind the times in Kabul. We're still calling it the civilian surge. And what it says about a potential crossroads that we've come to in Afghanistan that I think gives us hope, but also an opportunity for some important questions. Our view at UNAMA, when we first heard about the civilian surge, which is about the same time you first heard about the civilian surge, was great idea. But we've said that a lot in Afghanistan. Great idea. The question for this great idea, as with all the great ideas that came before it, was, is there a plan to go with this great idea? And there's good news. There is a plan, and when there's even better news, the government of Afghanistan has a plan. The challenge for the international community and the challenge for UNAMA in trying to bring the international community around is whether the international community is going to listen to the government's plan and follow it. Let me briefly tell you what happened. At the Hague Conference at the end of March, as you know, Secretary Clinton announced the new U.S. strategy. And included in that was a civilian surge. Shortly after the conference, when my boss, when Kai Ayada got back to Kabul, we called several key ministers over to his residence. And we basically shut the door and said to these seven ministers, here's your chance. You've been complaining for years about the technical assistance that's provided to you. We've all memorized the slogan, it's all supply-driven, it's never demand-driven. Here's your chance. Come up with a plan to help the international community provide you civilian advisors that you need and can be effective. But there's a catch. You got 2 weeks. Because we're talking about the United States here. And they're already moving out. They've probably already got this half planned. So you got 2 weeks to come up with a plan, and we'll help you get their attention. And it was an interesting discussion, what we heard from the other side of the table. A lot of support for us challenging them. I was very pleased that the new Minister of Finance, Omar Zahawal, said, I've got this. I'll take the lead on this. And, in fact, he got that endorsed the next day at the Cabinet. And they basically said to us, we'll do it. And we came up with a couple of milestones over the next couple of weeks to see if they were on track. And they left. And a process began, as I said, the next day in Cabinet that involved the entire Afghan government. It involved input from 22 different ministries and departments about the kinds of help they needed from technical advisors. But as important, what they also came up with were some key principles that should govern the deployment of civilian advisors that were quite impressive. And anybody who's familiar with the principles on aid effectiveness would recognize these principles as largely deriving from those principles. Very briefly, what the government said is, we want to be in charge. We want these guys, these advisors, to report to us. If they're going to be advising us, they're going to be accountable to us. We want these advisors to let us do the work. One of the lessons learned from the technical assistance that we provided them heretofore is that often our advisors make the decisions for them. It's hard to learn that way. And then another principle that they underlined was, we want these advisors to be effective. And what that means is, for the most part, we want these advisors to come from the region or from the Afghan diaspora. We want them to speak the language. We want them to be comfortable in our country, which is another way of saying we don't want them to have to be surrounded by blackwater when they go out and work with the ministries or work in the provinces. We want them to be able to live on the economy. We want them to stay a while. We don't want them to have to go home every couple of months to visit family halfway around the world and have a one-year assignment. We want them to be effective. And two weeks to the day after Kai and I challenged them, Minister Zahawal sent what I think was a very impressive letter to Ambassador Holbrooke and then ultimately to all of the other ambassadors representing the international community in Kabul, laying out this vision, these principles, with a very large attachment of individual jobs that had been identified by 22 ministries where they could use help. The beginning of a demand-driven request. UNAMA did something on the side at the same time. We also wrote a letter, and our letter was very simple, to the same audience. We said we like the government's plan, and we think in order to do it quickly, you can use existing mechanisms that are already deploying civilian experts in Afghanistan, managed by UNDP, the World Bank, bilateral donors, to get started quickly so that you don't have to reinvent the wheel and go out and recruit all these people yourself. There are mechanisms that you can use very quickly to get this started. And we also pointed out in our letter that UNAMA has capacity in the regions, in the provinces, to actually host civilian advisors, office space, bed space, logistics support. We have a lot of offices in the regions who would very much like to support this. So what was the reaction? Well, it was very interesting. So one of either two, so far I've heard two reactions. The one I've heard the most was, wow, this came from the government of Afghanistan. This is impressive. And I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, it did come from the government of Afghanistan. We were around, we were supporting, we were giving some guidance, but they put it together. But the other reaction, which is quite ironic, was, nah, there's no way this came from the government of Afghanistan. Somebody else wrote it. And that's wrong. But that is something we have to deal with. But I'll tell you, the pride in the cabinet and the pride in the government over this report, this plan that they produced, was high. They were proud of themselves. So what do we do next? This was just the first step, and the reaction has been positive. But like any positive reaction, it has led to lots of questions about, okay, now how's this going to work in fact? And so there's an effort underway right now to, number one, validate that list of jobs attached to the letter to make sure that it is correct, because it was put together quickly to meet our two-week deadline, to update these mechanisms that I mentioned, to be sure that we've identified all the existing mechanisms that could be used to deploy experts quickly, and then to set up a management structure for this whole surge under the JCMB so that we don't lose control of it or set up a parallel mechanism to manage it. And let me just conclude by saying why at least UNAMA is very excited about this. All of us for years, certainly I for years in my old job, have been pushing, exhorting, encouraging, shoving the government of Afghanistan to take some leadership, to tell us what they want us to do. And they've done it. Now the question is, are we going to follow it? Thanks.
Thank you very much. I actually got an email yesterday from someone at UNAMA who said that the political officers that they're hiring, almost all of them have past experience in Afghanistan, and over half speak Dari and Pashto. So I think that on the UNAMA side, they are really bolstering their capacity as well. Jim, over to you.
Thank you very much. I don't think I've ever spoken anywhere where they've queued in the corridors. Mark, this must be in your honor. Well done. I thought I would say just a little bit about DFID and then take a longer term, slightly longer term perspective than Mark has about Afghanistan. DFID is the British government's development agency, but it's also the ministry with its own cabinet minister. It has the majority of development spend within, well, actually almost all of the development spend within one department. It has a commitment from government to meet the 0.7% of ODA GNI target. So we're in kind of a privileged position to oversee the British development effort. But I'm very conscious that in Afghanistan, you guys are the 60% shareholder in the international venture. The UK is probably a 10% shareholder, so what you do really, really matters. What we do matters occasionally. In the UK, there's very, very strong support for the approach outlined by President Obama following the Rydell Review. To Afghanize, to let the Afghans lead, as Mark has been saying, to get towards an inclusive political settlement, to think about Afghanistan and Pakistan together. We agree very much that we need to see very early positive trends, because I think the positive trends of the first few years have been diluted in the last three or four. But also we need to have something which is sustainable before we can go. The principles that we apply in DFID are principles that we try to apply to fragile states. So looking for fair and inclusive ways for power to be shared, for states to have an ability to deliver the most critical functions of a state, so security, to be able to revenue raise and budget, to apply the rule of law, to meet the expectations of the population for jobs and some basic services, but not to expect that Afghanistan will suddenly or any time in the next 20 or 30 or 50 years become what some people may naively have thought it might become in 2001, which is a fully functioning state of the kind that we're used to. So the other set of principles that we use are the Paris Aid Effectiveness Principles. So we try to align our programs with Afghan plans, with the Afghan national development plans. We try to register our development spend on the Afghan budget and have about 80% of our development spend on budget. We try to spend our money in the country, so 90% of our budget is spent in Afghanistan of the DFID budget. We try to be predictable in what we spend, so we have a 10-year development partnership agreement, and we've just announced targets for spending over the next 4 years to give the Afghan government some predictability of what we do. In terms of the priorities, in this, we produce country plans and publish them in what we hope are user-friendly form. You can tell me whether or not they are. Anyway, the Afghan one looks like this, and there's various copies of it around. In it, we say that we're going to focus much more on growth and jobs. The Afghan economy has been pumped up by poppy and pumped up by aid money for the last several years. It needs to generate a lot more growth of its own. It has the potential because Afghanistan is on trade routes, because Afghanistan has agricultural opportunities and quite a lot of things that it has yet to exploit. The security situation constrains that, but so does the way the government operates. It takes, you have to get 13 licenses to export anything if you're going to do it formally. You can do something about that. They used to take 50 signatures to register a car in Afghanistan. It now has been reduced to 4. So, you know, you can do some basic cutting away of process to get rid of opportunities for corruption, at the same time freeing up private sector. We're working closely with the Afghan government on revenue raising. It's an interesting number that the Afghan government raises $750 million a year of its own, which is roughly equivalent to the SERP's budget that you guys have for Afghanistan. And, you know, if there's going to be a sustainability and an exit route from Afghanistan for the donors, somehow the Afghans have to generate their own revenue in a much faster way than they're doing at the moment. I think for the next few years, for the next year and then long, there needs to be a big focus on subnational governance. There have been improvements in the way that the central government works, not in every aspect, but there have been some in the way it budgets, for example. But that hasn't got down into the provinces, and we need as donors to decide whether we're going to fund through Afghan systems or whether we're going to use PRTs to fund governors. I think if we want to be sustainable, we need to use the Afghan systems and do less of using our own systems, which bypass what the Afghans do. We need to promote an inclusive political process. The elections will play some part in that, but they won't fix it. Finally, for us, as you know, British forces are in Helmand. I think over the last 6 or 9 months, we've got better at coordinating the civil-military piece in Helmand. We now have a civilian two-star who is in charge of the PRT in Helmand with a joint civilian-military staff. We're fortunate that we have a very good Afghan governor in Helmand, and we work closely with the line ministries, the provincial council, and the Afghan governor to try to extract resources from the central system in Kabul to show that the Afghan government itself can deliver for its own people rather than the British government doing it directly. There are other things I could go on to say, but I think that probably does my 5 or 10 minutes.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Thanks to both speakers for keeping short. I think we have a nice-sized audience. We've got a microphone in the back. So please raise your hand. Please try to keep your questions short and make sure they're questions. And introduce yourself first before you start. So I'd like to start. Okay, yes, please, right here. Push the button on the machine.
Great. My name is Karthik Balasubramanian. I'm with the Boston Consulting Group. And so we're just starting to have this nascent conversation within USAID about integrating private sector volunteers in the form of a civilian reserve corps that are subject matter experts into reconstruction efforts. So, you know, whether they're sanitation engineers or hospital administrators or logistics experts. It's really, really nascent. We haven't been able to do that successfully, and we haven't even gotten funding for it. Integration of real private sector volunteers. What's the status of that conversation in DFID, and are y'all doing that? And what do you think the prospects are for real integration of private sector volunteers in the Afghani reconstruction effort?
Okay, thank you. I'm going to take a few questions at a time, so yes, please push the button.
Yes, my name is Kami Bhatt, and my question is about the impression of corruption in Pakistan. Mostly Pakistani, even Pakistani-American, think that most of the money goes toward corruption. Mr. 10% would be probably, Mr. 20 or 30%. And when you hear the comments of Mr. Holbrooke, he was here last year, and he said maximum 10 to 15% aid goes to intended people. The people who really deserve it, most of that is corruption. So my question is, how can we get rid of this impression of corruption, or maybe it is a little bit corruption that turned people against U.S. because, for example, we do not see any big project like Russian project in Pakistan called Pakistan Steel Mill or HMC heavy mechanical complex established by Chinese. It provides jobs to thousands of Pakistanis, so people could see that, okay, these are friendly countries. But USAID, it's not very visible unless we have some earthquake or flood, and then you can see US helicopter, and then people think, okay, US could do some good things as well. But normally in this kind of aid that we provide, mostly we have elite who come here, stay in five-star hotels. Most of the money goes to consultant firm, and then how that money paid back to US by poor people who are ghettos. And this is the reason those people turned against U.S. foreign policy. Thanks.
Okay, we're talking about Afghanistan, but I think the same really applies as in Pakistan, and certainly the impression that too much money goes to contractors and needs to get through. So it's, you please, and then after.
Marcos Curiati, World Bank. I have a quick question for Mr. Ward. And Mr. Ward, you talked about demand-driven, great product from the government of Afghanistan in delivering this proposal and all that. Our concern is more from the supply side. And I've been reading here and there a few weeks ago, but it seems like State and Treasury are not that ready to provide that supply of to back up the civil surge. And also in terms of what type of civilians will be going there, experts, and will they be simply parachuted in? How long will they be staying? What about their language skills? The cultural milieu. So it's there is a plan. It's a great plan, but in implementing it, I think there are lots of questions. And you said obviously these plans always have questions. But to me, that is critical in terms of who you're going to get to go in the middle of Kandahar in some village that doesn't speak the language.
Yeah, great question.
And next thing you know, he's going to be delivering a Bible. I don't know. But
okay, thank you. Now, just this last one in the behind you, the gentleman.
Hi, Ben Barber with USAID. Mm-hmm. We've heard a lot of criticism of aid programs in Afghanistan, yet I have the feeling that there's a lot of good things that's being done by the aid program that are not being widely reported. Particularly, Mark and John, can you say, does the aid program have some success?
Okay, let's start with Jim, and then we'll go to Mark, and then we'll open the floor again. Can you proceed?
Yeah, thanks very much. I mean, there were a couple of questions about experts there. I entirely agree that we need to choose experts who have the right skills for the job. And Mark was saying that we should be, or the Afghan government actually was saying, we should look for expertise from the region. We shouldn't necessarily be sending lots of Brits or Americans to do these jobs. And I think that's a good point. I was talking to Papal, the head of the independent directorate of local government, and he was saying that actually they were negotiating with the Indian government. I mean, one can worry about the politics of that a bit, but, you know, the Indian Administrative Service has a lot of expertise on it's a bit of the glue that holds India together. Is it better to get people from that kind of background who know the region, operate in circumstances that are more like Afghanistan than people from the UK or people possibly from the US? In terms of volunteers from the private sector, I mean, some of the same points apply to that. In both in the UK and I think in the US, we're trying to recruit or develop databases of expertise from the public sector and the private sector. In the UK, we're trying to get 1,000 names onto a database of people we can deploy to stabilisation situations from both, you know, the civil service, but also from the private sector. So that's something that's underway. Good things that aid programmes have delivered. Well, I mean, Afghanistan started from a very, very low base in 2001. The numbers on access to health services now are much, much improved. There are 5 or 6 million refugees have returned to Afghanistan. There are 6 million kids in school who were not in school before. 2 million of them are girls. Virtually no girls went to school before. And a lot of this has been delivered through development programs. The ring road around Afghanistan, which is very important to the regional trade routes, is almost complete. So a lot has been achieved. And if the opinion polling of Afghans suggests that they recognize the progress on health and education, but it's not the primary thing that they worry about. The primary thing that they worry about is corruption and security in large parts of the country. Giving aid is, you know, it's a risky business, and you have to decide what your appetite for risk is. I think DFID, we're prepared to take calculated risks. You know, we force our staff to go through lots of risk analysis before we agree to spend. But if we've identified the risks and we've got mitigation measures, then, you know, we're prepared to go for things. And the alternative, and so we do trust partner government systems more than some agencies do. And we do tend to, you know, we work to strengthen those systems, but we look at the development outcomes. So more kids into school getting an education as a development outcome, more than we worry about whether the textbook that we've paid for has arrived in the school. Not that there's an awful lot that you can do with textbooks apart from use them as textbooks, but Mark.
Well, let me start with, I'll talk about the corruption. The way you put the question is very interesting. I mean, because you've actually, I think, posed two sort of impossible to reconcile goals. That is, spend money in Afghanistan as much as possible and avoid corruption. I'm not very smart, and I haven't figured that one out yet. I think this goes to Jim's point about accepting some risk. Your vice president, my vice president, said to us at UNAMA the week before he became vice president, I'll accept, as then a senator on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, losing money to incompetence. I'd rather lose it that way than overhead in the United States. I agree with that. And I think that one way to spend, as DFID does and other donors do, more of the funds appropriated by various legislatures around the world in Afghanistan is to start using Afghans more to carry out our programs. And that is going to require some of the donors relooking at the way they carry out their assistance programs and not rely so much on old systems that are based on very large, easier to manage contracts and grants. I mean, you made my points on the civilian surge. I mean, that's right, and that's why we're pushing the government's plan, because it is making the point that parachuting in, you know, a farmer from Surrey or Missouri, I tried to think of two that rhymed, but then I pronounced Missouri right. It may not be the most effective way to deliver expertise on agriculture in Farah, but looking at expertise in the region just might. And there are ways to do it, and that's why I mentioned that in our letter that accompanied Minister Zachelwal's letter, we pointed out there are existing mechanisms managed by credible donors that are doing this now, but on a small scale. And those programs could be ramped up to respond to a portion of this surge. And that's exactly what we hope will happen, so that someday the international community can say that it was responsible for deploying Indian experts, Pakistani experts, Tajik experts, even, ladies and gentlemen, Iranian experts who know something about whatever the need is the Afghans have identified. And finally, on successes. Ben knows. I mean, I've got these all memorized. I used to have to testify about them. But the two success stories that I like to tell, and Jim already mentioned them, damn it, are the two that allow me to make the point that when the Afghans lead, we have greater impact, and that's basic education and access to public health. In both of those sectors, you had a minister in charge that knew how to say no and had a plan. And both of those ministers shut the door at one point and said to the donors, the time for talking is over. We now have a plan. This is how we're going to do access to public health across this country. We're not going to have 17 different approaches because we have 17 different donors. The Minister of Education said, this is the way we're going to build schools and train teachers. We're going to do it one way. It's called the Afghan way. I've listened to all of you. I've gotten your advice. This is how we're going to do it. And because the donors got behind an Afghan plan, we have over 80% of the people with access to basic health care, and we have over 6 million kids in school. The highlight of my day, every day, driving to work in Kabul, is seeing the kids walking to school. And I see it every day. I wish there were sidewalks for them. I worry about that. But they are there, and you know, it's a great sight every day. Because there was Afghan leadership, we got results in those two sectors.
That's right. Maybe, Justine, is there anybody outside, though, and then we'll come to you, who has a question? Yeah, okay. The people we can't see, but maybe we can hear from them. Hamid, okay, great.
Hi, thank you to all of you. I have a question actually to Jim. And the new
Hamid, can you introduce yourself, please?
Oh, Hamid Arsalan. I'm currently a graduate student and I'm originally from Afghanistan. Most of the aid focus has been in Afghanistan towards mostly the south and the east. So in the new country plan that especially the Fed has, is there any room for other parts of the country, especially the north and the west? And Ian Amman could be answered as well. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, there's a big concern that if we ignore the north and the west too much, that will be our next problem. Yes, please.
Hi, my name's Russ Webster, and at the risk of getting booed out of the room, I'll say I work for a contractor, DAI, and we're involved in local government development. I wanted to ask either of our speakers to elaborate a bit more on some of the challenges of shifting to an important territory, which has been referred to many times already, and that's subnational government. IDLG has a key role to play. Be curious to see if anyone can elaborate on you know, perhaps Mark, on the challenges facing IDLG as a relatively new yet centerpiece in terms of the effort to develop local government. But this is a huge challenge, and I would just appreciate any further comments that either the speakers may have on what the Afghan government faces in terms of successfully developing subnational governments. I will mention also, for anyone who doesn't know, you would be astounded if you haven't seen it, the low level of institutional capacity, beginning from infrastructure to human resources to basic systems, the low levels that exist in Afghanistan. So throw out any notions that you might have from other development contexts, because the challenges there are huge just in terms of institutional capacity, and then you layer risk on top of that. So any elaboration on some of those points would be much appreciated.
Okay, the gentleman in the back of the room, you've been waiting patiently. Yeah, you come up and use a...
Timothy Walton, Georgetown University. In regards to the UN, the Afghan government, the British government, do you have a formal analytical tool for identifying where you want to allocate aid and what levels of aid, much along, I think, the lines of how the World Bank does it? And if so, has that changed, incorporating lessons over the last years, or lessons from Iraq? Thank you.
Okay. And Justine, can you get Mark over there? He has a question in the back. Thanks.
Hi. Mark Schneider, International Crisis Group. I'm curious whether or not there's any difference of views between the two gentlemen with respect to the utility of PRTs as deliverer of development assistance in Afghanistan.
Troublemaker.
And particularly if there's a need for some kind of common benchmark that says that this is the level of insecurity that requires PRTs and this is the point at which they're no longer required. And if at this stage, really the only place where you continue to need PRTs is in certain of the south and eastern provinces.
Great. Okay.
Thank you. I have a question for my name is Hamid Saburi. I'm an Afghan student here in the States. My question toward is, what are the priorities in the civilian search project? Is it education, economy, security? And I just had a quick comment about Jim, that he mentioned about the successes in Afghanistan. He talked about education, 6 million children in Afghanistan. I think most of the successes we're talking about, there are in a couple of main provinces in Afghanistan. It doesn't basically go beyond those provinces. So I think majority of the provinces in Afghanistan are basically ignored, and much projects are not implemented there. So I just wanted to make that comment, that those majority of those provinces are sort of like ignored.
Okay, let's just take two more. The lady in the back, and then you. Yeah.
I'm Carrie Hunnigan. I'm from the Rendon Group. Okay. Concerning sustainable infrastructure, you were speaking about agriculture before and how you've decreased the amount of criminality and corruption within agriculture, and that's wonderful. And I guess our girls in schools and health. But I was wondering how you're going to keep sustainable if people are so worried about corruption and being safe. If everyone is so worried and there is so much criminality still rampant, especially in agriculture with drug cartels, how are you going to continue to make sure that people are safe and that people can sustain or create a sustainable agriculture?
Great. Okay.
Yes. David Isby. Mr. Drummond, the division of aid into multiple programs, even within the divisions between UN, US, UK, if it has been identified as a weakness. Recently over in Afghanistan, I had DFID identified by one observer as being particularly bad in this regard, and he perceived this as being exerting its bureaucratic independence against British diplomats and soldiers as delighting them. How do you see that?
Okay. Let's go to Mark first this time.
I don't know why we give Jim time to think about that one. We should go right to that one. Thank you. I've forgotten now who it was that asked about balancing the aid among the provinces, but thanks very much for asking the question. I'll pay you afterwards. This is a big issue, and it's one that UNAMA speaks out on a lot. And we speak out on it a lot in London, at The Hague, others do in Canberra, in Ottawa. And our message is, as Karen said, a very simple one. We understand completely why there is an interest in spending a lot of resources in those provinces. We understand that very well. However, if you look at the security map for the country over the last, say, even 7 months that I've lived there, it doesn't stay the same. The bad guys are smart, and the bad guys are going where we are not. And we can't afford a new front. So what our message is, and I fear sometimes that it gets lost, just a sliver. That's what I always say. Just spend a sliver. Slivers are very thin. Spend a sliver of what you're spending in the province you care about most in some of the other provinces. Because a sliver of what some of those capitals are spending in the provinces where they are focused would make a huge difference in Dikundi, in Balkh. Well, Balkh's actually in pretty good shape. In Baghlan, in Bamiyan, in some of the provinces that are beginning to worry us a little bit. IDLG and subnational governance, this is a tough one. You know, we all adore Jelani Popal. But we've been trying through the JCMB, the Joint Coordination and Monitoring Board, to bring some order to the development activity at the subnational level. There's a lot of activity. The donors need coordinating, but so does the government need coordinating. And so at the JCMB, we took the bold, very bold step of suggesting creation of a task force. You know, when there's a problem, create a task force or a working group. But the idea was make IDLG sit down with the other stakeholders at the subnational level and hear what everybody else is up to. Is that, we think, may have been missing in the past. So we're hopeful that that will lead to a good dialogue about what is not only going on, but what needs to be done at the local level that has been absent in the past. We look forward to seeing the fruits of that discussion, perhaps even at the next JCMB, which will be this summer. Very quickly, PRTs. I've always been a fan of PRTs. However, my concern today in 2009 is that in those provinces where the Afghan government has created institutions of local governance, if the PRT is continuing to deliver services, they are doing harm. In those parts of the country where the Afghan government has the capacity on the ground to deliver services. So that's probably not the South and the East. But in those parts of the country where the government is there, has some capacity to deliver services, we want the people to go to their government to solve their problems, not the PRT. And so we are beginning with a lot of coordination with ISAF to have this conversation. And I'm very pleased to say that it's a good conversation. We're not having doors slammed in our faces. People get the point. And it's a good point to get because it shows progress in certain parts of the country, that there are places where the Afghan government can deliver services. We got to get them resources, and we have to give them the opportunity to try and stop doing things for them. And then I'll just very quickly, I'll let Jim deal with narcotics. I can talk about that as well. But very quickly, the priorities for the surge, it's a good question. It was very interesting. What most of the ministries asked for and what most of the provinces asked for is really boring stuff. Procurement, expertise on HR, expertise on managing projects, and accounting. We call them the common functions. Boring stuff that no government can survive without. That's what they asked for before they got to anything very technical. And then there was a lot of that stuff as well. But these five common functions, or four or five, however many there are, HR, accounting, procurement, project management, and then a sort of policy design, policy formulation. They're called the five common functions. That showed up more than anything else.
Are we allowed?
I think I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint the gentleman who wanted to divide Mark and me on PRTs. I don't think there's very much between us. I mean, PRTs are essential for the delivery in the insecure places, but they are a parallel system, and what the Afghans need is to be delivering for their own people in the places where they can. And so there are questions about whether we need PRTs in, is it 26 of the provinces of Afghanistan, something like that, but and whether they're actually displacing some things that the government could be doing for itself, or the subnational government could be doing for itself. I think that the subnational governance challenges, I mean, part of this is about training enough people to perform the basic functions that Mark was describing. But part of it is also deciding, for the Afghans to decide amongst themselves, what kind of subnational governance do they want. Do they want governors who are in charge of budgets for health and education? Do they want to leave that with line ministries? At the moment, they have provincial councils, but provincial councils which don't have any executive authority and are really just consultative. I think if I was a provincial councillor, I'd get rather fed up with that role. But maybe in Afghanistan, they don't. So I think they've got quite a lot of sorting out of that to do, and the IDLG is on the case and making quite good progress and is putting forward legislation to change, clarify the roles. Gentleman asked about what analytical tools DFID uses to prepare its country plans. I mean, I wish we had a formula which gave us all the answers. What we actually do is commission research on conflict analysis. We do an evaluation of what we've achieved in our country program over the previous 4 or 5 years, and try to take the lessons from that. We do a poverty analysis, we do a gender analysis, and then we throw them all together and come up with what we come up with, but hopefully evidence-based. Fights in the British government, yes, we have them. There is a healthy debate, I think, which ranges between the DFID approach, which is instinctively to look at longer-term sustainability, and the military approach, which is much more to look at short-term delivery. And, you know, both approaches are understandable. I think, have come closer together in the last year, and certainly the way we're doing business in Helmand now, where I describe the setup of having a two-star civilian lead. That two-star civilian lead will, in the next rotation, will be a DFID person. That debate will continue in lots of governments, and but I think we're actually in a better place for it. About 20% of DFID's resource will go into directly into Helmand, but there's also some other cross-government money from something we call the Stabilisation Aid Fund, which the majority of which is spent in Helmand. Helping other parts of the country, yes, absolutely. And one of the new programmes in agriculture will be aimed at districts which have become poppy-free, and to try to make sure that they don't revert. So in order to give people the incentive not to revert, you need to invest something there. And I hope this is something that we'll be able to work with the US government on, because it seems to me quite an important initiative for the Afghan government to have taken.
Do drugs.
I mean, I think the problem of poppy in Afghanistan is not going to go away quickly, frankly. There are a number of things that we can do about it to make it a riskier crop to grow, and you know, there's an argument for some, not too much eradication. There's certainly an argument for investing in alternative livelihoods for people. We've had what we hope will be quite a successful program of providing wheat seed in Helmand. We're not quite sure yet whether it's just increased the volume of wheat grown or whether it's also decreased the volume of poppy grown. But I guess we'll know that in the next couple of months. It's undoubtedly the case that a lot of money generated from poppy goes into buying positions in government, and that's something that the Afghan government, with some leverage from the donors, needs to address. I think there's quite a lot of the petty corruption problem in Afghanistan that can be dealt with by what I was talking about before, which is trying to get rid of some of this excess of process and procedure. You know, if you have to get 50 signatures and have to pay 50 bribes for something, and actually you can change it and you've only got to pay 4, then that's quite a lot of progress. And it might also help to get the economy moving faster. Okay. Did I forget anything?
I think that's all right. Thank you. I mean, we heard also last week we had the new representative for the Canadian office in Kandahar and how they were actually using the British approach for civ-mil relations. So we do try to share innovations as widely as we can. Mark, did you want to do a quick comment on the drugs from the UNAMA perspective?
Yeah, I don't want anybody to think UNAMA is shirking the drugs issue. And Jim made the point, but it goes back to the point we started with, and that is a more balanced approach across the provinces to aid. The fact is that we've got close now to 20 provinces that are poppy-free. That's something to be very happy about. Ben, add that to the list of success stories. However, as Jim said, they can go the other way again. We saw it happen in Nangarhar a few years ago. We cannot take our eye off of the provinces that have gone poppy-free. And there is a risk of that when we focus too much on a few provinces.
Okay, I think we have time for just two or three more questions. So one over here. Want to come up and...
I'm Howard Burris, former CFO at OPIC, former director, Reconstruction Support Office at DOD. I think all the initiatives about using local delivery mechanisms and forms, certainly people who can live on the economy or even losing local contractors to build sticks and bricks is really laudable and a great idea. And a dollar goes a lot farther without all the overhead. What we found was as great an idea as it is that there were always issues that, and I guess that's what I would ask, how would you all work around the so the legal issues as far as using appropriated U.S. dollars? I don't know about other countries, but using appropriated dollars and developing audit trails that will satisfy the legal obligations. Because, again, it's a great idea, but what we found working in Iraq, we had to do, there was the backflips were so awful in trying to find a way to comply with the appropriation language that it was a problem. So devil's always in the details.
Yeah. My name is Farishta Sakhi. I'm from Afghanistan. I'm a graduate student at Eastern Mennonite University. My question is around the nature of JCMB. What we have been observing in Afghanistan that most of the coordination bodies are the platform for sharing the success stories of the projects and programs. I would like to know more about this platform. Is it more around sharing the information and success stories, or are there some serious and realistic efforts to create a platform and draw the resources of different stakeholders for creating trust fund and responding to the priorities of the government of Afghanistan, which are in shape of Afghan National Development Strategy or Compact of London, and certain other strategies so far have been introduced.
Thank you very much. And then the last question is over here. Justine, do you mind? Thanks.
Thank you. I'm Malou Innocent, Cato Institute. Just a quick question. For a lot of these infrastructure projects, do we hire Afghans for them, or do we just send private contractors, and do they then hire Westerners to then go there? Just nuts and bolts as far as that's concerned. Thank you.
I can start. I think most of those were more in Mark's direction than mine, but I think in the UK we have I wasn't going to say more relaxed, but we don't have quite the same constraints that you operate under in the
I work for the UN.
In the US system. No, not you, but in the colleague over here who was who was discussing. As I said at the beginning, the DFID spend is sort of 90% in Afghanistan. The other 10% is for consultants who work on capacity building in the ministries, on budget systems, or in agriculture. And the construction work that we do tends to be using Afghan systems to do it. As somebody said earlier on, that delivers a product more cheaply. It does come with some risks that you may lose bits in transmission. I mean, lose some of the money in transmission that you obviously have to be careful about. But there's a useful number on the cost of classrooms if built by international contractors at $45,000 versus $13,000 using Afghan systems. I don't have direct experience of the JCMB. My impression is that it's, that it takes a lot of preparation to get to a successful meeting, and that actually quite a lot of the harder-edged donor coordination, deciding who's going to do what, has to happen behind closed doors with the Afghans, and probably with a smaller group of donors who have most of the money available, and principally, of course, the U.S. government. Infrastructure, I think that was a question. Well, I've kind of answered that for the U.K. perspective.
I think the scrutiny under which the United States operates in Afghanistan is extraordinary. Three inspectors general watching them. Their own inspector general, the GAO, and now a special inspector general just for Afghanistan. And in that environment, risk is a hard sell, taking risks. But I can't think of too many countries on this planet that more scream out for trying something new. So something's askew there. And to compound it, the security rules that clamp down on the officers that serve for DFID, for USAID, for CETA, and make it very difficult for them to get out and see what's going on with all of these projects that they're accountable for, also makes this very difficult. So, and I'm not suggesting, UNAMA is not suggesting, when we advocate more use of local contractors, that we reduce the standards. No, just the opposite. We want Afghan firms to meet international, very tough standards. That's what we all ought to be aiming for. But we probably need to give them an opportunity to bid on smaller projects. They're just not going to be competitive for a very, very long time on big jobs. So we have to think about the way we structure our assistance programs to give the Afghan firms a chance. The JCMB. Well, I do have personal experience with JCMBs, both speaking at them as well as a lot of work behind the scenes to make them a useful 3.5-hour exercise. Let me give you an example, because the woman that asked the question, I think, put it very well. Let me give you a vignette from the last one, which was April 19th in Kabul. You asked, you know, basically, what are they good for? The new Minister of Agriculture, with a little bit of help behind the scenes, made a presentation that wowed everybody. He presented five priorities succinctly, clearly. He handed out a paper for each one. The paper was short. It had a budget attached. And he said to the assembled crowd, which was all the donors and the cabinet, I need your help. And this is my number one priority, and it was wheat seed. This is how much I need, this is how I need it, and this is when I need it by. The JCMB provided a perfect opportunity for him to present that. Now, it took a lot of homework behind the scenes getting it to the point where he could hand out papers. He could present a succinct proposal. He had a clear budget. But that's what the JCMB is good for, is it can drive us behind the scenes, the international community, and particularly UNAMA, to get the government ready to make those pitches to the international community. Who does the work on infrastructure? For the most part, there are very, very few exceptions to this, but there are some, sadly. The Afghans are hired to actually do the work. You know, in terms of dirt flying, it's an Afghan at the other end of that shovel. What we'd like to see more of is, as you work up the management chain, you also find Afghans. Maybe you're always going to need some expat expertise overseeing the whole thing. We're not saying let's change this 100% overnight. But there is certainly some Afghan participation now at the sort of laborer level. We'd like to see more.
Well, thank you very much. We promised our speakers that we would try to stick to an hour, and I think we only went over 5 minutes, so they can get to their next meeting. So please join me in thanking our speakers for a really interesting conversation.